Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Now, when we look at our wheat crop, though, we have wheat in variable conditions across the region. We have many fields that have already been disastered, and then we have fields that are just barely hanging on.
Dr. Jordan Bell, Texas AgriLife Extension Specialist on the Texas wheat crop.
So this wheat is definitely beneficial to some of those fields that have not already been disastered. And then, of course, fields that are irrigated, this will be some beneficial added moisture. When we look at the amount of moisture that we received, probably anywhere from a half an inch to over an inch around the panhandle region, depending on the rain that came prior to the snow, and then, of course, the moisture equivalent from the snowfall event.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One of the things that we as an industry are doing together and want to make sure that everyone in the room is aware of is we're doing a celebration of modern agriculture on the National Mall. And there'll be 22 different industry associations and 13 different equipment manufacturers, including everybody on the stage here, all sharing this technology with regulators and policymakers and the general public in a manner that they've never seen before.
That's Kurt Blades with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. And then on the mall, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
I'm very appreciative of AEM for giving us this opportunity to celebrate National Ag Day on the mall. And there's no question that there's a tremendous amount of innovation and creativity that's being viewed here today to give people an opportunity to understand the nature of business, the commitment of American agriculture to innovation, to creativity, and sustainability. But I got to tell you, it's 160 years ago that Abraham Lincoln decided to establish the Department of Agriculture. And as I thought about this tour today, I just couldn't help but ask myself, I wonder what Abe would think. Really, I wonder what he would think. You know, when he started the department in 1862, there were about 90% of America lived on farms. And he started the department with the idea that if you could take that knowledge and spread it and improve on it and innovate, that American farmers could basically, it would be endless what they could do. So I'm pretty sure that were he here today, after all welcoming us and saying Happy Ag Day, he would probably think and say something far more profound than what I could say and will say today. But I'm pretty sure he would reaffirm his commitment in the strength of agriculture and American agriculture. I'm pretty sure he would also reaffirm his belief in the innovative capacity here in the United States for us to basically invent and create. And I'm pretty sure that he would also believe, as he believed back then, that a country united can do the impossible, and a country divided has difficulty doing anything. So I think about that today as I think about American agriculture. We've been through a couple of tough years. The pandemic has caused a significant disruption in our own personal lives and in our nation's life. It has disrupted the global economy and our nation's economy. But the good news is they believe that we are coming back stronger. The reality is that the United States and its economy is growing at a faster rate than any other developed country in the world, including China. And we've essentially set out with an innovative spirit, as displayed by the machinery here, to accept the challenges of today. We accept the challenge of climate change and agriculture's role in addressing it, in mitigating and adapting to a changing climate. We accept the challenge of dealing with high production costs in a way that encourages more precision agriculture that we're learning about as we look at these machines here today. And I believe that Abe's formula that he used in 1862 to unite this country is still applicable today as we look at these challenges of climate, pandemic, supply chain disruptions. I think he would absolutely believe that America's agriculture is getting stronger and will continue to get stronger.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It did pass out of the House. The Senate marked up their bill just a couple of days ago. There's a little bit of confusion about differences in the two bills. I'll make it easy. The House bill is better. But listen, the Senate bill is okay, too. So rather than focus on the negatives, let's just continue to make progress. We're going to fight for our preferences. Our bill is more prescriptive. Our version, I think, will do a better job of providing clarity in this space. But let's get a bill passed. Let's get it signed into law.
South Dakota Representative, member of the House Ag Committee, Dusty Johnson, on his Ocean Shippers Reform Act. What are the odds they'll pass it?
Well, if you're talking about the intermediate term, say before the end of the 117th, I would put that percentage north of 80. It's hard to go higher than that in any bill because Congress is so dysfunctional and we kind of lose our way and we fight and we bicker. But the reality is this is bipartisan strongly and it's bicameral. And, you know, I have great respect for Amy Klobuchar and John Thune who are leading the effort in the Senate. I think we're going to be able to iron some of these things out. There's not a clear, there are three or four different strategies we could use to get this thing into law, from passing it on its own to having it attached to Coast Guard reauthorization, to having it attached to NDAA. But we know Leader Schumer wants it to move. And so, Brian, I would say I'm very, very bullish, well north of 80%.
And as much as he'd like to do it, he just says you cannot push the Senate.
Well, I've only been in D.C. for 3 years, but I know enough to realize that the Senate doesn't really like it when House members try to tell them what the timeline should be or even opine on what it will be. I know that Leader Schumer has made it clear that he wants quick action on this. And so, you know, I laid out a variety of strategies, some that could move in the next month, some that would be more year-end priorities. Everybody I am talking to, Brian, prefers the options that are coming up yet over the course of the next quarter. And so I think it's highly likely that we'll be able to get Senate action soon.
But how have the changes of the last 30 days affected and changed Congress? Johnson explains.
I think it has brought the parties considerably closer on these issues. And I think that's very good news. Now, we have dual challenges before us, Brian. On one hand, we need to deal with the short-term disruptions. So, for instance, fertilizer. We have to make sure that we're talking to Canada and that we're reducing tariffs on Morocco so that we can, you know, get potash from Canada. We can get other products from anybody who's got them. We're going to strain our capabilities to be able to, you know, get fertilizer where it needs to be and when it needs to be and at a price that is even halfway reasonable. But to a much greater degree, we need to be focused on, you mentioned realignment, and I think that's right. And really throughout COVID, I think, we've had many in Congress, more on the right, but certainly some on the left, who have understood we need to decouple key parts of food, medicine, and natural security infrastructure from our adversaries. We need to believe in free trade, and we should be doing even more with our partners. But we really should be, we do not want China and Russia to have asymmetrical authority over our ability to raise food and to, you know, maintain a country that is able to rally when those times arise. So I think you are going to see a strong bipartisan conversation about how to do more with Japan and India, the United Kingdom, a variety of different markets. And of course, you know, we want China to make good on their phase one commitments, but we don't want to put all of our eggs in that basket either.
South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson, it's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The density of the mineral as far as the minerals and especially the vitamins doesn't really need to be that high because the grass is going to take care of it. And I'm talking primarily vitamin A and vitamin E. So to save some dollars, a lot of us would just say, let's put the minimum amount of A and E in the mineral because the grass is going to have more and ample enough. Now, we have to make sure that the mineral has enough copper and zinc because those two trace minerals are very important for the integrity of the skin and the eyes. And so those are important to help prevent foot rot and pink eye.
K-State veterinarian Greg Hanselcheck on mineral supplementation.
But as far as the vitamins, put those at a minimum. And then as we get into the later stages of the pasture where they start turning brown, that tells us that the vitamin E and the vitamin A is actually not there anymore. that's the time to bring back a more dense mineral. And so it's a cost savings thing, and then the cows really don't need a fancy or a high dollar mineral during the early pasture season.
Hansel Check also talks about fly control.
Insect growth regulators and larvicides by themselves, they're very, very helpful, but we're going to need, you know, the old fly tags. It's still probably the best bang for your buck. There's some really good guidelines out there that if we're going to use those products, which we recommend people do, that we tag the cows. Research has shown two tags are much, much more effective than one. And I recommend don't forget the bulls. If it's safe and you can catch a bull, I'd put a couple ear tags in those bulls too, because they carry an awful lot of flies. And then the recommendation is if we've got pastures where we have a major fly problem, we've got pink eye on our calves, it may be necessary to tag them. But for most of us, we're going to start with the cows. We know we're building resistance in flies because we're using the same products year after year. And what happens, it kills the flies that are susceptible to those products. But the ones that aren't susceptible, they're the ones that are breeding. And so in time, our fly control becomes very inefficient. And so, yeah, if there's a couple rotations out there, if a herd's using just the pyrethroids and the organophosphates, we recommend they go pyrethroid, 2 years in a row, then go to an organophosphate, and then go back to 2 years of pyrethroids. If they're using a free chemical rotation, then they'd go organophosphate, pyrethroid, and then avermectins the third year. The point is just keep those products rotating so that we're not building resistance.
And Hansel Check rounds out the discussion by focusing on dewormers.
It's really important that we do something, and what we're trying to do is protect the calves from ingesting enough internal parasites that it affects their performance. In the past, we just concentrated on, you know, every cow as they go to pasture, we're going to deworm them. Our dewormers only last about 14 to 30 days, and so it's short-lived. There's some longer-acting injectables that'll go up to 100-plus days. But the point is that because we're seeing so much resistance with our ivermectins with internal parasites, it's recommended that we do not deworm all the cows as we go to pasture. There's a term called refugia, and to have refugia in our herd, then that recommendation is just deworm those that are under 5 years of age. Those cows that are over five, they have an immunity to the worms. They're not going to carry a heavy burden, and the worms they're producing will remain susceptible to the products we're using, and so we're not building resistance.
Kansas State veterinarian Greg Hansel Check. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I mean, we've got record exports last year. We're looking at record exports this year. We're looking at the highest income we've seen in agriculture for a while.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack at the National Ag Day event, just reflecting back on Abe Lincoln, who started USDA.
I think he would be excited about the opportunity that's now presented with American agriculture embracing the notion of utilizing resources from the Department of Agriculture and addressing in large-scale pilots and demonstration projects the notion of climate-smart commodities. I think he would be excited about the number of innovations and creative solutions American agriculture will come up with as it leads our country in an effort to mitigate and adapt to a changing climate. I think he would absolutely believe that if you give farmers the ability to make choices, if you incent them, there's literally nothing they can't do. I believe he would absolutely have confidence in our innovative and creative capacity. I mean, he would be astounded at what we just saw. A sprayer that can tell the difference between a weed and a crop. Now, Zippy can tell the difference, but this is a machine. It takes pictures. Takes pictures, retains the pictures for the farmer's use. Hey, this is your future. It's an exciting and challenging future. I think he would be excited, Abe would be excited about the fact that the United States isn't just dealing with climate here, but is leading an international effort. The United States and the United Arab Emirates started a process a few months ago to establish a partnership, a collaborative effort. We had a couple of countries and a few knowledge partners who believed that we could spread the word globally about innovation and productivity, and that sustainability and productivity aren't mutually exclusive. And now today we have 160 partners in our Aim for Climate effort. We initially thought we could raise $3 billion, and then it was $4 billion, and now we believe we can raise $8 billion towards innovative and creative solutions that will impact and accelerate what we're seeing here today, not just in the United States, but around the world. I think Abe would be pleased with United States leadership. I think he would be pleased in sensor technology, in robotics, in AI. I think he would be excited about the future for this country. And I believe he would be very appreciative that agriculture is united in this effort. All ag, all in. It doesn't make any difference whether you're an organic guy or a commodity guy. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a small producer with a small farm or a large producer. We all have a stake in this effort, and we're all engaged in this effort, and we're all working together in this effort. I think you would be pleased.
Bill Sack concluded his comments.
And finally, I think he would be pleased that we're expanding the notion of agriculture, the idea that it just doesn't have to happen in a rural area. It can happen in a big city, too. It can happen on a rooftop. It can happen in a building. It can happen in a lab. American agriculture, all in. So, folks, I think this is a great day to celebrate. We're out. We're together. We're united. We have big challenges, but big opportunity, and we're rising to the challenge. So I think, Deputy, that Abe would be proud of us. We believe that the brightest and best days of American agriculture, despite all the great things that have occurred, are yet to occur. And Katie, you're going to be helping make that day happen. Happy Ag Day, folks.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Since 2017, we've been conducting the Feeding the Economy study. It's an economic impact analysis examining the entire food industry in the United States. And I seriously mean this, from farm to fork.
John Dunham is the author of the Feeding the Economy study.
We calculate the economic footprint of everything from cucumber farmers to pickle manufacturers to the Publix down the street from me and the Lassen and Hennings Deli where I used to live in Brooklyn. So every aspect of food, from growing it to processing it to selling it. Now, our data show that at the beginning of this year, so as of point in time, the beginning of 2022, the industry was responsible for nearly 21.5 million full-time equivalent direct jobs in the country. So by direct jobs, we mean farmers, food processing workers, deli workers, people that are actually, I don't want to say this in a gross way, but touching the food that we all eat. When we include all of the suppliers to the industry and the induced jobs, which is the multiplier effect of the agriculture and food processing activities, the overall food and agricultural sector is responsible for about 43.5 million full-time equivalent jobs. That's a big, big industry. Overall, it's a $7.4 trillion industry. That's trillion with a T. Those are Washington kind of numbers. And it's equal to 18% of the overall U.S. economy. That's a substantial industry.
Dunham rolling out the results at a recent Farmers for Free Trade roundtable.
Feeding the Economy is a very extensive study. It breaks out the industry across 546 total economic sectors. So sectors from Wall Street to Main Street, from rocket construction to retail, from farms to homes. Every industry in this country is impacted by the food and agriculture segment. Just as an example, the industry is responsible for about 20,600 full-time equivalent jobs in the fertilizer industry. We were talking about fertilizer earlier. That's about two-thirds of all the fertilizer manufacturing jobs in the country. And remember, we're not counting all parts of agriculture. We're not counting cotton. We're not counting non-food agriculture, so tobacco production, cotton production, forestry, plants for landscaping, grass, things like that. So two-thirds of all fertilizer produced in this country goes into our food. Food manufacturing, the manufacturing sector, taking those farm products and turning them into products that are on grocery store shelves. Those are responsible for 2.4 million jobs. So that's everything from jobs in dairy producers to cereal producers to ice cream producers, every food manufacturing job. That doesn't even include, you know, tobacco manufacturers, cotton manufacturers, wood, paper manufacturing, which is in fact an agricultural segment. So overall, as a bottom line, the analysis shows the importance of the food and agriculture industry to the U.S. economy, not only in terms of ensuring that everybody is well fed and healthy, but also in providing good jobs, good wages, and importantly, $700 billion in tax revenues to our state, federal, and local governments.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Yes. People want to look at inflation, and certainly inflation has a lot to do with why prices are higher. Year-over-year changes were mild until April of 2021.
Gerald Nieper is president of TrueCot, headquartered in Bakersfield, California, talking about inflation and the markets.
You know, it took a year for, I think, all of this money sloshing around in the system to really hit home. About the time that things really started opening up and people could actually go out and start spending money, you know, April 2021, CPI jumped over 4% year over year and over 7% here only recently. Certainly, physical and monetary policies, the sea of liquidity to fight COVID impacts, was a very legitimate and main driver. But you had other things going on also. You know, weather played an important role. Weather's probably the biggest factor of higher prices, said Craig Turner, senior commodities brokers with StoneX. February 19, 21, Texas freeze drives demand for natural gas while clogging wells with ice. Spot prices rise to a record almost $24 per million BTU. The coal crimped chemical plant production left along the Gulf Coast. Worst drought in decades in South America hurt the corn crop, and the Parana River in Argentina fell so low you couldn't get a fully loaded boat. Drought in North America hurt electricity production in the West. Natural gas and coal were burned to cover the shortfall, driving up prices. Hottest June on record in North America kept AC on and fuel prices climbing. Wildfires in bone-dry forests of the Pacific Northwest. Sawmills were choked off from forests and customers. Lumber prices jumped. Floods in British Columbia cut off sawmills from wood. Spring wheat crop hurt by drought. Crop down 44%. Prices jumped to the highest level since 2008. Bone-dry Canadian prairie resulted in poor oat crop and record prices. Flooding and a power grid strained record temperatures hurt tin makers in China, where tin is crucial in making circuit boards. Hurricane Ida slams into the Louisiana Gulf Coast on August 29th. Nearly all the Gulf natural gas output was knocked offline. Higher prices for electricity, gas for heat, cooking, and fertilizer. Thankfully, the second warmest October on record for North America and a warm November enabled somewhat of the gas and supplies to be replenished. So, yeah, fiscal and monetary policies instituted from the beginning of COVID outbreak certainly contributed to inflationary pressures, but the confluence of other factors have only worsened these inflationary shocks. Good example of this is index of fertilizer. Before Ida, yeah, fertilizer prices were rising between January and September. You know, they were all up about 50%. But look at what happened since September after Ida. They really took off. And with the situation going on in Ukraine right now, I imagine this is going to look a lot worse in another month from now. And we haven't even talked about supply chain disruptions that haven't even been mentioned, or wage hike, or herbicide, or insecticide pricing. The supply chain disruptions had has encouraged textile mills and retailers probably to order more than they would normally order. And now you've got the latest inflationary driver, you know, the complete invasion and incursion into Ukraine. We still don't know what the outcome of that's going to be in terms of grain, fertilizer, and all these other pricing levels.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One factor that has made the low supply, high price fertilizer situation worse has been something that has daunted almost every product that you can think of, and that is
logistical challenges, just transporting fertilizer.
We got that from the Fertilizer Institute's Jenny Martin. We talked to her out here on the mall in Washington during Ag Day. That was on Tuesday, and she says there has been a shortage of trucks and truckers to haul fertilizer. However,
the biggest thing we're seeing right now is the rail strike in Canada is impacting our ability to get product into the United States, specifically in the northern states.
But at last, some good news. At almost the exact moment that she was telling us this, workers for the Canadian Pacific Railway came back to work after agreeing to abide by final arbitration. Now, it may take a few days to work out rail schedules and shipment backlogs, but fertilizer supplies from Canada soon should be once again coming across the border to U.S. retailers and farmers. Gary Crawford, Washington.